grateful to our choir, Keith. With all of your, Keith, I'm talking to you. With all of your abundant talents and gifts that you give so freely, thank you, truly. And he's being Keith about it. He's pointing at Amanda, and that's true. With all of your gifts and your experience to share them so freely in leadership on those Sundays when everything seems a little different and we're filling those spaces, thank God that God has given us one of everything we need. You know, from the outside, it's inconceivable. That's the word I keep using. And this letter that's addressed to a people today that we're reading, this letter is addressed to people who are scattered. Many of them are marginal. They're socially invisible in their communities. And yet Peter calls out to them and says, you are a royal priesthood. You're a holy nation. Shouldn't make sense. And it doesn't align with what it is that we are taught by this world, but Jesus is risen. And here we are on this side of Easter being built into something that we did not build ourselves. And so we're in our fifth week of Easter, 4 weeks in. The risen Christ has emerged from the tomb and has been moving outward into all sorts of spaces, into a locked room, onto the road, at the table. Last week, we talked about the fabric of daily shared life in the early church, and he is there. And today, we're going to stop and, in a sense, take a little step back to see if we can begin to see the contours and the lines and the levels of what exactly is being built in the presence of the risen Christ. And Peter gives us a whole lot of insight and leadership toward that very answer. And it may change a lot of the ways that you understand your place here at Yates and understand your place here today on May the 3rd, 2026. And whenever I read 1 Peter, it always helps for me to hold on to a mental picture. Because some of the letters that we read in the New Testament, of course, are very personal. They're written, say, by Paul to a particular church or churches in a particular location. But 1 Peter is written in a more general way, a pastoral epistle, a pastoral letter to people all over what is now Turkey. The ancients called it Asia Minor. And he's writing to Christians who may be alone in their little community. He's writing to Christians who may just form a small little house church surrounded everywhere on all sides by people who do not share their convictions or beliefs. And so I'll say, imagine taking a handful of stones and you just sort of throw them randomly out into your yard. And there they scatter. And there's no real logic. There's no real coherence. There's no way to completely understand how they fit together. They're just sort of dispersed. And they're spread all around the yard. There's no category for them in their little location. They're just rocks that have landed where they've landed. And that's who Peter's writing to today. That's who he's writing to, this handful of stones that are thrown across the yard. All of those individual stones, each one right where it landed. No obvious patterns, no clear connections with others, no relationship that they can perceive to anyone else. And that's how Peter begins this letter, by using the metaphor of people as being stones or rocks at all. And I think Peter always had a very special relationship to that identity, of being a rock. Because, you know, at Caesarea Philippi, that is the nickname that Jesus gave him when he commissioned him. And he gave Peter a mission and a purpose. Upon this rock, I will build my church, he said. And what a beautiful and generous thing now, so many years later, to see him share that name, that calling. that picture. It was never his and his alone. But to everyone who receives and hears those words, you are living stones, he says. And he's inviting him into that exact same work that he has been about. And so that's the passage that we're reading today. 1 Peter chapter 2, verses 4 through 8 at first, and then we'll read verses 9 and 10 in just a minute. And so the apostle offers these words, "Come to him, a living stone, though rejected by mortals, yet chosen and precious in God's sight, and like living stones, let yourself be built into a spiritual house, to be a holy priesthood, to offer spiritual sacrifices acceptable to God through Jesus Christ. For it stands in Scripture, 'See, I am laying in Zion a stone, a cornerstone, chosen and precious, and whoever believes in him will not be put to shame.' To you then who believe, he is precious. But for those who don't believe, the stone that the builders rejected has become the very head of the corner or cornerstone, and a stone that makes them stumble and a rock that makes them fall." The very first thing Peter gives them to do is to come. Did you notice that? Before Peter says anything to these Christians about what they're supposed to become, or about what they're supposed to accomplish, or about what they're supposed to produce, he says, come. Because no community in the presence of the risen Christ begins with our initiative. It begins with the approach. It begins with moving toward the living stone, says Peter. It begins with that orientation, that new orientation, rather than better organization, I guess. And I want you to notice what he says about that stone before he says anything else. There are two verdicts that are kind of held side by side, rejected by mortals and chosen and precious in God's sight. Completely opposite verdicts, and both are true. The living stone here that Peter is preaching about is the cornerstone. And you know what the cornerstone is. It's that stone from which everything else gets the right angle and the right lines and the right levels. Everything else is measured from that point of origin. And so in construction, it's more than just something ornamental that you carve the date of building into. It's a structural necessity. And we know that if you get the line or the level wrong at the outset, just by a fraction, the error compounds over time. Windows won't fit in their frames, and doors won't hang right. Roof joists can miss their connections entirely. And what looks straight, maybe a foot or two out, will look visibly crooked by 20 or 30 feet out. It's a powerful image. It's reinforced for me in the quarries in Aswan, Egypt. You may have seen a picture of a particularly vivid stone. It's 137 feet of solid granite, an obelisk that was being carved out of the granite in the quarry there. Almost 1,500 years before Christ. And as the carvers carved, and as they made their way toward finding enough space to get underneath it, and I wouldn't even presume to understand the engineering of moving that 1,200-ton obelisk. But they're very far into the work. It's clear as you look at it from overhead. Somewhere along the lines, as they were cutting that stone out, they realized that there was a horizontal crack in it. That when it was rendered upright, would break into bits. It would collapse under its own weight. Who knows how long the masons had been carving on that 137 feet of granite? But they abandoned it. It remains there to this day. The builders rejected it, because it was cracked. It would have no use for what it is they envision being able to do with the stone. And Peter is writing to these believers who have staked their lives on someone that the builders of the world have rejected. They've staked their lives on a crucified Galilean peasant who is humiliated, who was executed publicly, and buried in a borrowed tomb. And the builders of the world make their assessment. Structurally unsound. Categorically disqualified. Leave it where it is. And they were wrong. Because the one that the builders have abandoned is the only cornerstone who has no crack. Is the only one whose foundation doesn't compound error over time and space. Won't shift, doesn't shatter under the weight of actual human lives. And everyone who trusts him, Peter says, will not be put to shame. That word shame is the next important note I want us to hang on to today. Because we need to, in some ways, distance ourselves from the modern therapeutic notions of shame. Peter's not playing an armchair therapist. He's not saying that if you trust Jesus, you're going to avoid disappointment or personal exposure. He's using the word the way they used it in the first century, where shame wasn't something that was personal. It was not something that was internalized. It was a social verdict. Shame was exclusion from your household. Shame was being banished from civic life. And in that culture where honor and shame were everything, shame said, you have no place. You have no name. You have no people. But now in Christ, Peter says, God pronounces a different verdict. That's not you. That's not you anymore. The world's builders may still be making their assessments, and they look at the crucified and risen Jesus, and they come to some conclusion that he's, I don't know, not load-bearing material, at least not for serious people in serious times. And they may give charitable verdicts. He's an interesting teacher, a helpful ethicist, historically kind of curious, but only in moderation. He's not the ground on which anything real can be built or sustained. And yet, when you come here on a Sunday morning, I want to remind you that you sit down with people who have no obvious logical reason for being seated next to you at all. People of different ages, different tax brackets, different political instincts, different amounts of sleep last night. Different, to be sure. And our country is struggling even to agree on what a fact is. And you could very well be sitting next to somebody who voted differently than you. And even though you did, we share our money, we share our worship, we share our needs, we share our prayers, we share our time, we share our service. That is not nothing. I hate to use the double negative, but it's evidence of the building that God is building, and it should not hold. At least that's what we're told now. On this side of the resurrection, though, this is what happens when you build on the right cornerstone. And then Peter takes another step toward those who are sharing his letter and hearing these words today. And it's something his first readers would have felt all the way in their core. The word he uses to describe the social condition in which they find themselves. I said, you know, throw rocks in the yard. He uses a Greek word, peripidemos. There'll be a quiz after class today. But I use that word because the modern rendering of resident alien is close. But it just rubs me the wrong way. Peripidemoi were people who were called that, not because it was a legal indictment. It's not a legal word. It's not a slur. It wasn't mean to call somebody that. It's something that the ordinary Greek-speaking people that would use to talk about somebody who is physically present in a place that isn't their hometown. You know, here but not from here. Does that make sense? Maybe you know what it's like to live someplace for a long, long time, but still know deep down somewhere you're not part of the tribe. Have you ever had that experience? In Peter's world, everyone who's reading this letter knew that life was structured in a certain way. Your household, your oikos, and your city, or your city-state, your polis, were everything. Those were the things that gave you your identity. Those were the structures that gave you protection. They were your network of obligation. They would take care of you. Your first commitment was to take care of them. And for those who could not claim that, where they happened to be, they were parapodemos. They were outside of all that. They weren't illegal. They certainly weren't despised. Not necessarily. They were just unanchored. They had no kin group to advocate for them. There was no magistrate who had a personal interest in making sure that they were taken care of. There was no community whose honor was really bound up in yours at all. And the letter that Peter's writing now is to people who knew this from the inside. Because for as long as people have been mobile and lived in societies and structures just like this, they've tried the same survival strategy to fit in. To fit in. Because fitting in is the closest thing that they could do that felt a little like belonging. But with a little modern sensibility, Brené Brown in her book, Gifts of Imperfection, reminds us that fitting in is actually the exact opposite of belonging. It sounds surprising, but she says it this way. Fitting in is about assessing a situation and becoming who you need to be accepted. But belonging, on the other hand, doesn't require us to change who we are. It requires us to be who we are. And so Peter takes this word that in their world marked them as outsiders, and he places it inside a reality that's so much bigger than they could conceive, that the world had ever given them, that the label loses its power. Because the world that Peter's writing in said, you are parapodemos, you have no social standing here. And Peter says, you are parapodemos, you're a royal priesthood. A royal priest of God. And so when we hold those two things side by side, on one side, everybody could see the picture that's being painted here. The Roman priesthood required you be patrician by birth. You were elected to that role out of the senatorial class. You would be robed in really fancy robes for all the public processions. You were one who was oriented to the very highest echelons of power in the imperial cult. To be a Roman priest was to be someone who stood right at that intersection of religious and political and social power. Talk about anchored. Talk about rooted. Talk about being one of the tribe. It's the most established position maybe in the entire order of things. But then on the other side, the people Peter's writing to, with no civic standing, no kin group to protect them, socially invisible or dispensable by the standards of the institutions around them, they're desperate for belonging, and Peter says, you are royal priesthood, citizens of a nation beyond the boundaries of any family or any city-state or any empire at all. And that's not an eventually sort of statement. That's not an aspiration for some point in the future. It is now. He speaks in the present tense, you are. In the exact conditions they're in that scattered collection of households, this letter's being passed hand to hand, run to the next village. People hardly know each other. If they do at all, you're all part of that royal priesthood. And that home that they've been living in, that they've been performing for and trying to adjust to and just shrinking to try and survive in, as they tried to fit in, it would never give them what they needed. But the home that God is making does not require masks or scripts or performance. The church that lives in the resurrection is a community they already belong to. It's a community they already belong to, there and now, here and now, with the people sitting around them. God's presence already among them, in them, between them. And that outsider label, you're not from here, becomes a badge of honor that says, I know, because I'm a priest of Almighty God. I'm a citizen of a holy nation. And that's not just to inflate self-esteem. We're talking about a royal priesthood, a place where our deep belonging is shared with those that the empire and the voices of the world would just never deem worthy. And it's been given by a God who's always chosen to operate that way. You are a chosen race, he writes, verse 9. A royal priesthood, a holy nation, God's own people, in order that you might proclaim the mighty acts of him who called you out of darkness into his marvelous light. Once you were not a people, but now you are God's people. Once you had not received mercy, but now you have received mercy. Let all that land. Let it all land here, a chosen race. That word chosen can be sticky sometimes, but it's not a declaration of your worthiness over against somebody else, kind of like those children hoping they get picked at recess to be on a team and not left behind. That's not the kind of choosing that's being talked about here. This is an affirmation of God's intentionality, God's freedom to choose, and God's choosing to work with the foolish and the weak and the marginal and the scattered. The chosenness of our identity isn't your privilege. It's God's method. A holy nation. A nation that transcends and extends beyond our geography, our ethnicity, or our politics. And it's defined first by the relationship to that living stone to which we all have come. Citizens, there's no map that's going to be able to mark out where you are. There's no tribe. There's no government that can ever revoke. You are God's own people, says Peter, acquired. God's own. Treasured and kept. Y'all aren't just a crowd that God tolerates. God's not just waiting for someone better to come along. You're not lost in your unfinishedness. You are a people claimed by God for God's own sake out of a specific darkness into a very specific life. And then this one that I've tried to emphasize today, a royal priesthood. Every person in this room, a priest. A person who drove in a little anxious about the diagnosis or the waiting from the call from the doctor. That one that's carrying a marriage that's just too heavy and is harder than anyone knows. That person who came out of habit hoping maybe they could be surprised by the end of today. All of you, priests. All of you, priests. Whether you came out of habit or whether you came out of necessity. And it's not because of the lineage or the pedigree or the credentials that you brought to this time. It's not about your resume, your spiritual CV. It's because of the one that you have come to. And now you are mediating the presence of God that we experience and share and celebrate and worship together in this place. You mediate that same presence in your words and in your silence and in your works and in your presence. Wherever you go, the office, to the kitchen, to the school pickup line, to the hospital room, This is God's plan for reaching those places where you go. And that's what this whole passage is moving us toward. It's not arguing for God. It's not trying to defend God. It's declaring what God has done and what God is doing. And that the way you declare something is that you declare what you've seen with your own eyes. Declare it. Because you can't keep quiet about it. And then we're assured. What is formed here is the sort of identity that will never be broken or shaken. Once you are not a people, but now you are a people. Back to the yard. Anytime you could look in the yard and see those scattered stones, you could send somebody out there to try and figure out what they're doing there and why they're organized the way they are. They pick them up, they turn them over, and then they drop them again. But what we are now intended to see, with eyes deeper than our own seeing, is the scarred hands of one who loved us so much, he'd reach up and turn that stone over and say, I've got just the place. And walk it over and put another brick in the wall or the side or the room, just where it needs to be. And there, with the logic that is only God's to contain, every place has its fit. That's what the risen Christ does. It's what the risen Christ does in our congregation, in each one of your lives, and with all of our lives together. You are not here by accident. And I don't want you to wait until you feel useful. You're already being fitted together. You're already being given the necessary gifts. Sometimes simply by what you carry into this place, your history, every wound, every new experience, all of it is being built and has been under construction since Easter into something that, yes, isn't finished yet, but it's not our design. And the world's builders are always going to look at gatherings like this one, and they'll look at the church, and they will not see the obvious reason for us to be together. But today we are reminded in God's word that the risen Christ looks beyond this gathering and sees a house, a spiritual house, built from a chosen race, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, God's own possession. And God is still building. Cornerstone's been laid. And the one that the builders left in the quarry, who was cracked, they thought, worthless, has been chosen by God, is precious, and that stone becomes the one that sets the angle and the level for everyone who's joined to him. Once you were not a people, but now you are God's people. So if you're going to do one thing this week, here's your one thing. Mr. Rock, I just picked it up out of here. You can feel free to use one of these. Maybe you have one in your yard. Maybe there's one in your driveway. Find a stone that fits in your pocket. Drop it there. And women, I'm sorry. So many of the women's clothes don't have pockets. You're going to have to find a way to be able to pat somewhere and be reminded that you're carrying it around. Maybe it's in the morning as you're getting dressed. Maybe as you're shifting gears from one space to another, simply ask yourself this question. Every time you're reminded that you're carrying that stone with you, where does God want me to be a priest today? Where am I going? Where am I going to be sent? If it's to the office, it's to the office. If it's into a difficult conversation, let it be. It's to that neighbor you've been wanting to check on, do it. You don't need a script. You just have to show up and bear the presence of the one who has called you to this time, who has granted you mercy that Peter says we can now share in the world. That's all you need to do this week. That's the way God has always been working through us as the gathered and scattered church. And if you have never made a decision to turn toward that stone who began this time of reflection today, then today is the day to come and say it and be placed. And if Yates is the place where you want to be fitted into this people, into this priesthood, this holy nation, you can say it this morning. If there's something else that you've been carrying around and you simply need to set it down, then today is that day to set it down. Because we're going to be singing after we give. And I want you to remember that you are not spare or disposable parts. You are not here by accident. You are stones in a living house. The builder hasn't finished. You are not spare parts. You're essential building blocks into the house God yearns to dwell in.